This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Chris Hedges joins us to talk about the need for an independent political action.
What does it take to defend ourselves? Chris Hedges thinks not voting for the Democratic Party.
Bruce Ratner joins us to talk about his new book, Early Detection.
This is a significant, significant contribution to humanity. Just like his older brother Michael Ratner made a significant contribution in the field of constitutional rights, Bruce Ratner has made one in the field of early detection of cancer.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The growing repression and censorship in the United States is manifest daily. Already, some 3,000 students have been arrested, and many of their pro-Palestinian encampments on college campuses have been violently closed down. The so-called paper of record, the New York Times, has instructed reporters not to use the words genocide or ethnic cleansing. Journalist Chris Hedges has been removed from the Real News Network for interviewing Dennis Kucinich, the independent candidate for Congress in Ohio, and for not supporting the presidential candidacy of Joe Biden. The necessity for independent political action, independent of both the Republican and the Democratic parties, is the lesson that many social activists are drawing. Journalist Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report coined the phrase "the more effective of two evils" in describing the Democratic Party. Significant social change comes from organizing people independently. The rise of the CIO, the civil rights movement, and the movement to end the war in Vietnam are illustrations of that truth. In appreciating the role of the Democratic Party, social activists are increasingly concluding that independent political action now will help us during the next presidential administration. We speak today with Chris Hedges, the journalist and author, about the collapsing media landscape and what happened to him at the Real News Network, as well as how we can preserve journalism. Chris spent two decades as a foreign correspondent, serving as the Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief for the New York Times, where he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. He's the author of 14 books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which he co-wrote with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, and also The Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, please tell us what the Real News Network is and what happened to you over there.
So the Real News Network is primarily has one funder, T.M. Scruggs. He told, according to the editor-in-chief, Max Alvarez, that if the Real News did anything in his eyes to contribute to the election of Donald Trump, he would pull the funding. That's just an inverted way of saying elect Joe Biden. There's been a certain animus between Scruggs and myself. I had written a column for Shearpost where he had also contributed, where I defended the writer Alice Walker from charges that she was an anti-Semite. He demanded that that column be removed or he would cut his funding. Bob refused to remove the column and the funding was cut. I had posted an interview with Dennis Kucinich, a former Democratic member of the House, former Democratic mayor of Cleveland. He is running for a House seat in Ohio in the current election cycle as an independent. That segment or show was taken down from the Real News site, and then my show was terminated. The reason I was given was that I jeopardized their nonprofit status. There was nothing that I said in that show or any other show that jeopardized the nonprofit status. I'm fairly certain that this came from their donor. And, you know, that is the problem of this model of wealthy individuals or corporations running news organizations. Not our job to elect or not elect anyone. It's our job to report and to give a platform to a wide variety of voices, including those such as Dennis Kucinich or independents.
Chris, the Democrats are trying to get more people into their camp by talking about how horrible Trump is, and we know that's true. He is horrible. But you said there isn't much daylight between Biden and Trump. It's only been the independent action of courageous students that may succeed in tempering Biden's support for the Israeli onslaught. If Biden were to back down from his support of Israel, would you then consider supporting him?
That isn't going to happen, Heidi. I mean, he is a product of the Israel lobby. He took more money from AIPAC than any, he has taken more money than any senator in American history. And then he left the Senate several years ago to become the vice president under Obama. He's a creature of corporations, the credit card companies in Delaware. They used to call him Senator Credit Card. Obama picked him because his voting record is essentially Republican, including opposing bus segregation, opposing the right of women to control their own bodies. He called for the invasion of Iraq 5 years before we invaded Iraq. He was a full partner with Clinton in the omnibus crime bill that nearly doubled our prison population and three strikes you're out laws, so people didn't even have a chance for parole. Militarizing police, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, if he embraced boycott, divestment, and sanction of Israel over the genocide, but that is, you know, like asking if elephants can fly. He owes his political career to these forces. He's a product of these careers. And you could argue without this kind of money and support, he and figures like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, and they wouldn't even have a political career. I mean, in a fair election or a fair primary election in the Democratic Party, without the huge infusion of lobby money and corporate money, Bernie Sanders would have won. So we're talking about, you know, someone who is emblematic of a system of which really can be boiled down to a form of legalized bribery.
Chris, when Ronald Reagan was president, one of his top aides described the Democratic Party as a capitalist second favorite party. Now it's their first. Please talk about that.
Well, that goes back to the Clinton administration, where the Clinton presidency realized that if they did corporate bidding, they would get corporate money. Tony Coelho, the congressman from California, was instrumental in this. And what Clinton, in essence, did was transform the Democratic Party into the Republican Party and push the Republican Party so far to the right it became insane. On all of the major issues, war, wholesale surveillance, trade deals, deindustrialization, austerity, there's no daylight between the two parties, or very little. The split or the differences tend to revolve around cultural issues, which are not unimportant, of course. But that's what Ralph Nader, you know, called out during the Clinton administration. And that's why Ralph mounted an independent presidential run, because he said essentially corporate power, and no one has been fighting corporate power longer and with more integrity than Ralph Nader. Corporate power has essentially seized the two-party duopoly. And that's right. So what does Obama do? He's elected with a promise of reform. 2008, he immediately craters and abjectly serves the interests of the banking class. So yeah, you know, that's what's happened. And that's that deforming of the political process and the two-party system has, I would argue, led to the rise of a demagogue like Trump. Remember, since 1996, this is when figures started being amassed, we have had 30 million mass layoffs, including members of my own family. Much of my family's from Maine, from rural Maine. So that is what is essentially created this dysfunctional system that sees these buffoonish but very dangerous figures rise within our political system as echoes of Yugoslavia. I covered the war there. The war was caused not by ancient ethnic hatreds, but the economic collapse of Yugoslavia that vomited up the same kinds of figures that we see, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, et cetera, these figures. In that case, it was Radovan Karadzic and Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman and others. That's what happens when society sees up and a dispossessed working class has no discernible redress. And that's the fault of the Democrats.
Well, to address what you just said, we do not have an independent party, at least not yet. But all politics isn't electoral, is it?
No, and I think the students, the very courageous university students across the country, have shown us that. The Democratic Party completely takes for granted their voter base, but it's very spooked by these mass movements that have called the Biden administration out for its deep complicity with the genocide that is taking place in Gaza. I think we've had over 2,800 students arrested. I've been in the encampments at Columbia University and Princeton University. This is the absurdity of arresting students on their own campus for trespassing, for calling in the NYPD police to take over a hall that was occupied, and they have their guns drawn. And Columbia, by the way, is under police lockdown. Unless you live in a residence hall, and most students do not, in the inner campus, you can't even get in. It's completely barricaded. There are police, along with private security, at every entrance into the main area of Columbia, as well as on the campus itself. Over 100 students have been arrested. I was down in the criminal courts watching them being processed. Many have been banned, threatened with suspension. And then, of course, we've seen some pretty horrific violence at UCLA with a Zionist mob that attacked. I just want to say, having spent a lot of time in both, especially the Princeton encampment, but also Columbia, an estimated 30% of these protesters are Jewish. This has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. The media has been awful in terms of essentially shifting the focus away from the genocide to this canard that these students are somehow anti-Semitic. And of course, if you look at the incidents, most of the attacks have been carried out by Zionists against the protesters, including on the steps of Lowe Library at Columbia this January, where three former IDF soldiers who are now students at Columbia attacked students with skunk spray. You know, there are all sorts of incidents. If you look at the SJP websites, they'll chronicle these, you know, people being insulted, people being punched, people having beer poured over them, etc. Especially people who are clearly Muslim, women who are wearing hijabs, etc. So, yeah, that is what has frightened the, and that's always true. Movements, as Howard Zinn pointed out in the People's History of the United States, it's movements that have opened up our democratic space. We created a very closed system as a country. And whether that's the suffragists or the abolitionists, the labor movement, hundreds of American workers were killed for the right to unionize and the right to strike, the civil rights movement, etc. It has been movements. And that's why the repression against these students has been so draconian.
Chris, please talk about the independent political action with respect to civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and now the opposition to the genocide in Gaza. It looks like, at least by appearances, that Biden has shifted and given bombs to Israel, the two-ton bombs. Do you attribute that shift to independent political action?
I think it's a more of a rhetorical shift. Remember, he just greenlighted another $1 billion worth of weapons. You know, Israel, I think, depends now, gets about 68% of its munitions from the United States. That pipeline is not stopping. The Biden administration is well aware that this assault on Rafah will result in even more catastrophic, especially with this cutting off of all aid into Gaza at the Rafah crossing, will even more catastrophic death and injuries to Palestinians who've been forced to move 5, 6, 7, 8 times from one supposed safe area to another where nowhere is safe. They're being pushed now to Al-Muassi, which is largely filled with sand dunes, but even that is shelled. So they know what's coming, and I think that they are trying to at least rhetorically put a kind of distance between themselves and the Netanyahu government and the Israeli occupation forces. But they're full partners in what is happening. They're not ignorant of what is happening. This is about perception. It's a form of political theater. It's not about actually attempting to curb the genocide.
Chris, I recall you're talking about how you had urged Bernie Sanders to run as an independent, and he said no to you. In retrospect, do you think that was an error? What might have happened if Sanders had run as an independent? Do you think a grassroots people's movement would have become more effective?
Yeah, Bernie decapitated his so-called political revolution the moment Hillary Clinton became the nominee, and he urged everybody to support Clinton, so where he could pull thousands, I mean, up to 10,000 people during the primary when he was running around telling people to vote for Clinton, he was lucky to get 100 people in the room. You're not going to build a political revolution in an election cycle. But Bernie's answer to me and Shama Sawant, we were both pushing him towards running as an independent, was I don't want to end up as like Ralph Nader. In other words, I want to be able to caucus with the Democratic Party. I want to get my committee chairmanships through the Democratic Party. I don't want the Democratic Party to turn on me and push me out of office. So it was a career decision. But it was a betrayal because, you know, it took Seresa. Seresa was polling at about 4%. A decade later, they control the government. But it takes that long. And of course, the two parties have conspired to make it almost impossible for third parties to get on the ballot. Teresa Armato wrote a very good book on it. She was Ralph Nader's an attorney in her own right, but Ralph Nader's campaign manager. On every state, you know, they shut them out of the debates ever since Ross Perot. They challenge all the voter lists to run up the legal costs, whether they're valid or not. So there is a collusion between the two ruling parties to essentially make third party or independent candidates unviable.
How do you counter the accusation that a third party candidate is a spoiler?
Well, that factually, of course, that's completely untrue. They did that to Ralph after the Florida recount. But of course, they only recounted, I think, two counties and then sent it to the Supreme Court, where George W. Bush was anointed president by judicial fiat. I mean, Al Gore couldn't even carry his home state of Tennessee. So the Democratic Party is always, I mean, you know, Trump is a Russian asset. They will look to deflect attention from their own betrayal of the working class, which is the engine behind the rise of this dysfunctional political system and these troglodytes who rise up and express, however crudely, a very legitimate rage that working men and women feel, particularly the white working class. The black working poor, of course, are constrained by felony convictions in the carceral state. We have 25% of the world's prison population. Most of those people are poor, black, and brown. And we're less than 5%. So it's that form of social control, which is coercive, along with militarized police, has largely shut down the political aspirations, because with a felony conviction, which you can, you know, get like drinking water if you live in what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, precludes you in most states from voting. So that demonization of the Trump supporters is a way to not examine or confront the complicity of the Democratic Party in its corporate-sponsored assault on working men and women and the rise of the gig economy and everything else.
Chris, given your experience not only with the legacy media and more recently the Real News Network and the growing censorship that's happening across the country, what advice do you have to young journalists who are trying to be investigative reporters and really get at the truth?
Well, this is what is so frightening. So figures like myself, Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, who already are known quantities, can migrate to Substack, which is where I am now. That's a subscriber-based website. We bring in enough that we can do our work. But that's not true if you're not known. And you speak about investigative journalism. That's very labor-intensive and very costly. I did it. I wasn't primarily an investigative reporter, but after 9/11, I worked on the investigative team. I covered Al-Qaeda in Europe and the Middle East, based in Paris. And I think all of the costly aspects of journalism are being abolished, including, of course, investigative journalism. That's why Julian Assange's release of documents was so important, is so important, and why the state has persecuted and carrying out its slow motion execution of him in Belmarsh prison. But journalism itself is dying, just in terms of numbers. And Barbara Ehrenreich, before we lost her, used to say, to be a journalist now means you're going to live in poverty. And that idea of the corporate owner, whether that's MSNBC or CNN or the rich billionaire, whether that's or a multimillionaire, I don't know if they have billions, but the multimillionaire who owns sites like Alternet or Salon or The Real News, those models don't work because they have their own agenda, and that agenda is anathema to journalism. It's not our job to elect anyone. That, you know, if Joe Biden wants to beat Trump, that's his job, not ours. So otherwise, you just become a house organ for the Democratic Party. You're no different from the old Pravda or anything else. So it's an extremely distressing time for those of us who care about journalism for the reason you raise, in that for young journalists, it's extremely difficult for them to find even the most minimal financial backing by which they can do their work, although some of them are out there doing incredible work.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with Attorney Heidi Boghossian. This is Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with Chris Hedges. Chris, here's the question of questions. How might an independent political party come into being?
So I think Shama Sawant, who was the socialist city councilwoman, I think she's right in that it has to come out of labor. Now, as you are well aware, Michael, the assault on American labor has been long and quite ruthless. I mean, we can all go back to the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, but we have seen the number of unionized workers. I think it's about 11%, but only about 6% in the private sector. Why? Why all the right-to-work laws? Why? Because the power of the working class is the power of the strike, and our corporate masters are determined to take that power away. So I think the rise of any independent political movement has to be very, very closely wedded to organized labor movements, because the one power we have that they are frightened of is the ability to shut them down. And that, of course, you know, this has been after I was up with the Columbia students after they cleared their encampment, and they said, well, we're coming back in the fall. And when we come back, it will be strikes. It will be university-wide strikes, faculty, staff, and students to shut the university down. And that is the power that the corporate state has worked very, very hard to revoke, to take away from us, and that's the power that we must recover. And as we recover that power, we must give it a political expression.
Chris, what did you make of the union, the UAW Local 4811 out in California, voting to authorize a strike by 48,000 workers in the University of California educational system?
Well, that is the tactic that we have to employ, because we can render these corporatized university structures helpless. Remember, the corporations now, the corporate model is the one that has been adopted by universities. These bureaucrats, like the president of Columbia, she doesn't come out of academia. She comes out of the World Bank and the financial sector. And all the bureaucrats who run these universities are pulling around salaries in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Again, they come out of the corporate sector, usually. And then the teaching load is often carried up to 70% by adjuncts. And these are professors with PhDs, but they earn $4,000 or $5,000 a class, $25,000 a year, often without health benefits, job security. So the corporate model has also destroyed our university system. And of course, by carrying out these kinds of strikes, we can begin to create pressure on that system to change. So it's extremely important.
Chris Hedges, we've run out of our allotted time. How can our listeners follow your work?
ChrisHedges.substack.com. And that is where I will reconstitute the show. I'd had a show for 6 years on RT. RT was closed. My entire archive was erased by YouTube. Now, after 2 years at The Real News, they've shut the show down. But on Substack, you know, I have enough control that because it's subscriber-based that I can reconstitute it. And that's where all my writing goes out as well.
Great, Chris. Thank you very much for the interview. And you've got our total solidarity. You take it easy.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Cancer, declared by President Richard Nixon over 50 years ago, has been a failure. Mortality rates for victims of cancer have not decreased, except for the successful campaign against smoking. Attorney Michael Ratner, when he was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, helped found Law and Disorder Radio 20 years ago. We lost him to cancer 8 years ago. Michael's younger brother, Bruce Ratner, has co-authored the book Early Detection, Catching Cancer When It's Curable. It is dedicated to the memory of Michael Ratner. Bruce and Michael shared similar values. Over the years, cancer rates have pretty much remained the same, very high, particularly affected our poor people, rural people, and people of color. Most money spent on fighting cancer by big pharmaceutical companies goes into researching and developing medicines for late-stage cancers. These medicines have proven to only prolong life for several months. So what's the answer to truly combating cancer? Early detection, and it must be quite early indeed. Funds currently misdirected could be used in this effort. Prostate, breast, colorectal, and lung cancers can be detected early, but too often they're not. Even when they are, many people don't follow up with treatment. A blood test has been developed to identify 50 different cancers, but what's missing is a massive program of education and organization to catch cancer in its early stages. To discuss this is our guest, Bruce Ratner. He studied science at Harvard, graduated from Columbia Law School, and then taught at NYU Law School. New York City Mayor John Lindsay appointed Bruce to be the Commissioner of Consumer Affairs. Bruce went on to develop real estate in Manhattan and Brooklyn and brought the first professional athletic team, the Brooklyn Nets, to Brooklyn, where he developed the Barclay Center, where they played. He also sits on the boards of Weill Cornell Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital. He has initiated the Michael D. Ratner Center for Early Detection of Cancer. Bruce Ratner, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you. I'm just delighted to be here. And speak to you. And of course, it has a special meaning because both you and Heidi started this incredible program with my brother Michael, who unfortunately died of cancer. And so it's really, this is a particularly important moment for me, I have to tell you.
Well, for us too, Bruce. Bruce, why has the medical profession not advanced further in developing cures for cancer?
So there are a few reasons. First of all, cancer is a very complicated disease. A one-inch diameter little tumor, which isn't very big, could have a billion cells, all of them mutating or at least dividing many, many more times than a normal cell, and then it can travel, and it's extremely complicated. Plus, there's 50 different cancers. Like, no two cancers, frankly, are exactly alike. They fit in categories. But it's a really difficult disease. It's not like with polio, it was hard to get a vaccine for, but it was one disease. Now you're talking about many, many diseases. So that's one reason. The second reason, I think, is that a lot of money goes to great scientists, and I've had the honor of knowing them and working with them, and they're incredible, and they really do an amazing job on figuring out how cancer happens. However, what is not spent money on is something really important, and it's early detection of cancer, because cancer can be cured when it's caught early. It cannot be cured easily, or you very slight chance of survival if you get stage four, meaning the most advanced cancer. For example, lung cancer, if you catch it early, you have probably an 80 to 90% chance of surviving. If you catch it late, like in stage four, you may have 9 months to a year, and probably only a 10% chance of survival on the average. So you've got to catch it early. Now, no significant money has been spent by the government, pharmaceutical companies, or even hospitals on early detection. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The first reason is interesting. If you discover a cure for advanced colon cancer, you will get a ticker tape parade. If, on the other hand, you go preventative and catch it early, nobody really notices. So one, there's glory. And the second reason is that if you go back to the history of the National Cancer Act, which happened with Nixon, there was a much heavier emphasis on advanced cancers and basic research as opposed to clinical research and clinical work. And that was unfortunate. It was a big fight between Kennedy and Nixon won, and Kennedy lost. And so we did not put, ever since then, significant amounts into early detection. So that's the second reason. A third reason is that it continues because it is what I call the military medical complex. Why do I call it that? Because there's a lot of money to be made in making drugs, pharmaceuticals. There's one that's advertised all the time on TV, probably even radio. It's called Keytruda. It's called an immunotherapy. It's for advanced lung cancer. The average length of survival is 9 months, and it costs $22,000 per treatment. And if you're able to live a year, it's going to cost you $200,000, or at least somebody, government insurance and so on. So the pharmaceutical companies have a huge incentive, huge, to spend the money on cures, frankly, or attempted cures that really, obviously, my brother survived 8 months, and it was wonderful and great to have him for 8 months. On the other hand, it was a painful 8 months because he was on chemotherapy. And that's what happens we all experience cancer through a family member, a father, a mother, other family members, friends. This is something that's not unique to me or to either of us on the phone. It's to everybody, and that's why it's really important. So those are the major reasons. You know, this program is called Law and Disorder. Well, I will say this. There is disorder in the medical community, and what do I mean by that? One, the different reasons I've given, but the other thing is we have what I call a fractionalized system. So we cannot decide that, oh, my goodness, here's a great treatment. Let's have everybody use it because one doctor may say this, another doctor will say this. And I'll give you just one really incredible example. If you have prostate cancer, very often they will take out your prostate. You have to do about 250 operations as a surgeon to be good enough to almost make sure there's no recurrence. On the other hand, the average urologist only does 3 per year. That's because the urologist can do what he or she wants to do. We don't have a uniform system, for example, as they have in the UK. And that is hard to fix. It's probably not fixable. So you have everybody going every which way with respect to treatment. And also, I have to add something else, which you may ask me about, but I'm going to jump ahead because the book that I wrote is about another thing, disparities. And I would say at least half of the material in that book is about disparities. And here's an incredible fact. African-American women and white women have the same incidence of breast cancer, yet African-American women have a 40% higher mortality. Similarly, Washington, D.C., Medicaid patients, almost 50% get diagnosed with cancer do not or are unable to follow up on the treatment. And those are just two examples. So we have a disparity problem in our whole healthcare system, but particularly in screening where you could avoid people getting cancer. And I am always just amazed and frankly angry that we haven't changed things. I was Consumer Affairs Commissioner at one point in my life many, many years ago, and that advocacy has always stayed the same. And I went with Michael. I went to law school with Michael during the rage years of 1968 to 1970 at Columbia. And I still have that rage in me about this subject.
Yes, in fact, you have a chapter called Death by Zip Code.
Yes, I do have a chapter called Death by Zip Code. Because there are things called social determinants. Social determinants are things like nutritious food, environment, job security, not having job security, difficult in finding a job, difficult in taking time off, and we know that is essentially people of low income. And I could keep going on with these social determinants. And when these social determinants happen, it is almost impossible to go through the labyrinth. They call it the continuum of cancer. I call it the labyrinth of cancer. So going through the labyrinth of cancer takes time away from your job. You're sick very often, and you've got children. You can't work. You can't feed them. A food desert occurs. And there already are food deserts, as you know. But when you have cancer, it's much worse. So those social determinants have everything to do with this terrible mortality rate with respect to low income. And one of the issues is that cancer, as you know, grows sometimes very fast. And African Americans, other people of low income, not that all African Americans are, but whether it be African Americans or other minorities who don't have advantages, have delay in any kind of treatment because they've got to miss work. They have to often get an insurance card. They're maybe far away from a place where they can get treated in a good way. There are so many different aspects. You know, I often tell this story. I say, if you are unfortunate enough to be a homeless person and you lost your shoe and you walked around and you got an infection, you'd go to the hospital and it would probably cost $10,000 by the hospital to get rid of the infection. If you're in Europe or the UK, you get a new shoe. And there's a safety net in Europe and many other places that we don't have here. We have some safety net, but nothing compared to other places in the world. And so that's another reason. We just don't have the right kind of safety net for people in certain zip codes, as I like to say. And it's one of the most important things I can think of about cancer, because it's hard to get early detection if you're, quote, in the wrong zip code.
Bruce, there have been successes with effective screening programs for cervical, lung, and colon cancer. Please talk about that.
Oh, that's a great question, Heidi. So we have screening for five different cancers: pap smears, colon cancer, breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate. However, that's only five cancers, and that represents about 45% of all cancers. However, the uptake, meaning the people who use it, is only 14%, and yet the tests are really good. Let's talk about successes. Pap smears. Pap smears are highly successful. It turns out that cervical cancer was close to the number one killer in the turn of the 20th century among all cancers that women can get. And that has changed because of pap smears, but it took 40 to 50 years for that to get fully accepted and implemented by the medical profession. It was discovered in 1928, and it wasn't until probably 1988 that, in fact, it became effective because it was used enough and was supported. That's one example. Colon cancer. Colon cancer was pretty much cut close to in half by basically the CDC working to get free advertisements over 15 years about the importance of getting colonoscopies. So those are two successes and two things that really work. Mammography works, but only pretty well. Mammography misses 25% of cancers, and there's a disparity issue in there also. But and lung cancer, the number one killer, only 5% of people who are eligible for that test actually get screened, and that's because there's no push by the government. There's no push, obviously, by pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, doctors. Half the time, you go to the doctor and you say, "Oh yeah, I smoked 10 years ago," and they don't even listen. So it is really, that is the number one killer, and nothing's done about it. So we have the contradiction between pap smears, which work really well but took a long time to adopt, and we have lung cancer, which has not been fully adopted and is not pushed and not used. And that has to change.
Bruce, I had no idea that there was a screening test for lung cancer.
Oh, my. Well, let me tell you something. I have a very close friend who read the book, and she had smoked many years ago, 15, 20, 25 years ago. And because of the books, you got what's called a low-dose CT scan. It's much like mammography, minor radiation. You basically get an image of your, say, from your neck to your, to, you know, down your chest. And they can look at your lungs and see if you've got a nodule and whether it looks cancerous or not. And it works incredibly well. If you catch it early like that, and you should, if you've been a smoker, a heavy smoker, or recently a heavy smoker, you have to really do that once a year. And I even think, even if it's been 20 or 30 years, you should get it. Now, it costs about $100 to $150. That's not covered by insurance, only if you smoke relatively recently. But you have to do that because our friend found a cancer. Fortunately, it was a small one and it was a stage one, and she's going to be cured. That's a perfect example. So lung cancer, I suggest anybody listening, you must talk to your doctor and get what's called a low-dose CT scan. Even if you haven't smoked in years and years, we all know people who've gotten lung cancer, every one of us, and they haven't smoked in 25 years. And the government doesn't tell you that. They all say, oh, you stop smoking for 10 years, you're fine. You're not necessarily fine. I don't want to scare everybody, but I really recommend it. I've seen lives saved. I just had this friend whose life is getting saved. So I guess my message today is you must get screened. And then second message is a lot more has to be done by a lot of different people. The industrial medical complex has to be fixed.
We're speaking with Bruce Ratner, Michael Ratner's younger brother, about the book that he's just completed, Early Detection, Catching Cancer When It's Curable. And Bruce, I just want to read our audience a quote that you've got in the back of the book by Dr. Vickers, who's the head of Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is the main cancer hospital, I think, in the world. And Dr. Vickers says, early detection provides an important look into testing and treatment disparities that exist in cancer care and thoughtful guidance. Expanding access is in everyone's best interest, as it has the potential to increase the chance of survival while lowering the cost of care. Very important, Bruce Ratner, very important book. Bruce, let me ask you this. What policies would you recommend for our country?
The problem is the Biden initiative, the House Republicans, surprise, are not voting any additional money, or if so, very little. They're not carrying out what he promised, not his fault. So that's the first problem. I hate to say money because that sounds like, you know, just a phrase, but in this case, we really do have to put money to it. If you were to look at how much money Keytruda takes in, that's that drug that I talked about before, revenues $25 billion a year, National Cancer Institute, $7 billion a year, and early detection, $600 million, which is a very minor amount. So number one is more money or change priorities, put more money into it. That's really number one. Two, we need to have mass media done, as we did in colon cancer, to inform everybody that actually the CDC had 20 billion impressions over a period of 15 years when they started talking about colon cancer. We all know about that. So that's the second thing. Third thing, we've got to make sure our doctors that do certain procedures are experienced, more experienced, say, at surgery. And also this issue of trying to come out with more screening tests. There's one that's out that's in the development, but you can actually, for a lot of money, buy it. It's going to have to be insured for all of us to get it, and can find 50 different cancers. Now, it's not perfect. It will miss some in stage one and two, but it's better than, I always say, perfection is the enemy of good. So it's not perfect, but it really is the future. So hopefully that will happen. I will make one other comment. The government, believe it or not, certain sectors of the government have done enormous amounts of things to stop that company from going forward, antitrust cases, which are wrong, and so on and so forth. So those are the major kinds of issues that we've got to get done.
Bruce, you write about your family history because it's not a unique one, is it?
So, yes, you're right. Cancer strikes every family. And in my family, when I was 5 years old, I had one grandparent only. And Michael and I slept in the same bedroom. My grandma got sick, so we moved out of our bedroom. She moved into our bedroom. I watched her die at that young age. And I remember thinking to myself that when I get old like she is, there will be no more cancer around. And was I wrong? Then the next thing that happened was Michael's and my mother got cancer at age when we were 28 years old, colon cancer because there was no test, and she died when I was 31 and Michael was 33. The next thing that happened, we had a wonderful sister-in-law who unfortunately got breast cancer at 36. She had a 6.5-year-old child, and she died at 42. And then, of course, Michael died of cancer. So it's been around my whole family. The news is I know that it's been around in certain degrees and more degrees and less degrees with every family in America.
Yeah, I'll say, Bruce, I could tell you the same story about my family, my father, my grandmother, my mother. In fact, you have in the back of your book, Early Detection, Catching Cancer When It's Curable, you've got a quote from Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. And he says, my mother died from breast cancer when I was 11. There's not a day that goes by that I don't wish we had detected it sooner. This book is an engaging, informative, and important work that will save lives, especially if policymakers take up the author's plea to fund more early detection testing. And that's the message that we have for our listeners.
You recommend using patient navigators. What is a patient navigator?
That's a very good question. A patient navigator is someone who helps you go through the cancer labyrinth from the very beginning. Let's say you need insurance, and this is particularly important in cases of disparities. So they may not have insurance, so the patient navigator helps you get insurance. You then go, say, get a CT scan or some kind of screen, and it comes out positive. The patient navigator helps explain it to you, may go to you with appointment, and then helps you through the whole labyrinth of making sure that you get appointments, that you go there on time, or in the case of even a colonoscopy, frankly, that you do it the right way. In fact, that's really how patient navigation was discovered. Someone named Harold Freeman, an African-American, 30 years ago, noticed that his patients weren't doing everything exactly the right way, and he began to get created the idea of patient navigation, which is essentially nurses or social workers who guide the person through the whole labyrinth. And he did it actually not with colon cancer, but with breast cancer, and it cut mortality down by significant percentages by having a patient navigator, including the treatment. So the navigator, it doesn't mean they literally follow them. They could be by phone or lots of different ways. So the patient navigator follows all of the different aspects of cancer. Look, when you get cancer, I would go with Michael once a week to his infusion of chemotherapy. And so that's what a patient navigator might do, because it's very hard for it to go individually. You really have to have somebody else around. If someone made a mistake, I'd be there to help, and so on. So often it can be a family member, but in my case, I was fortunate enough to know enough about cancer to be helpful to Michael. But people need help. We all need help. Patient navigators are particularly important, of course, for people who have limited means. I call it a Band-Aid. Why do I call it a Band-Aid? Because it's a Band-Aid for the failure of our social system to have really good treatment and putting money the right way, or because basically the issue of social determinants, we do not have the right safety net here, and so patient navigator has to be the Band-Aid to close the disparities as opposed to actually getting people out of poverty. That's really what it's a Band-Aid for what we should be doing. But we are where we are, and so patient navigations is a really good way to begin to close that gap.
Bruce, a friend of mine passed away from ovarian cancer. Talk about that cancer. Is there a screening for it?
There is no screening for ovarian cancer, and it's called the silent killer. So when I hear about different cancers, ovarian and pancreatic are the two that get me the most upset, and particularly ovarian, because it often happens to younger women. And the problem is that even if you get some kind of ultrasound or something like that, and they see what looks like a cyst, they can't tell whether it's cancer or not. And so they very often will take the ovary out, and it turns out not to be cancer. But equally important is the issue of it being a silent killer. It doesn't show real symptoms until it's stage four, which is very late and difficult to survive from. And I just can't believe that money has not been spent sufficiently, and it hasn't been, on early detection tests for ovarian and pancreatic. And frankly, if one pharmaceutical company, instead of investing billions of dollars to discover a drug that maybe saves lives for 9 months, which I think is a good thing that you get saved for 9 months, if they spent, I would think, just that amount of money on trying to get an early detection test for ovarian cancer, we would have that problem well in hand like we did with cervical cancer and pap smears. So that's just a bad example. I mean, a good example. It's a good example, but a bad thing that we have not come up with a test for ovarian or pancreatic. And so much money is spent by the pharmaceutical industry on drugs that do extend survival, but not very long. And it's wonderful to have my brother 8 more months for sure. But that kind of treatment cost the insurance company a great deal of money. And that should have been, money should have been spent on ovarian cancer and pancreatic cancer. By the way, that is not to say that the scientists, they do a great job. They are amazing. Honestly, I've met incredible people. But unfortunately, not enough money is put in the right place.
We've been speaking with Bruce Ratner, the author of the just-published book, Early Detection, Catching Cancer When It's Curable. I just want to mention, Bruce, that you got some help from your co-author, Adam Bonislavsky, on the book. And I wanted to ask you this really ultimate question, Bruce. What are you proposing in your book? Is it massive public education and mobilization? Is it that kind of project? And if so, what are the first steps?
Very good point. So the book is very important to read, knowledge, telling people about it, but it's also a platform to begin to make change. And so what I have started to do, and Adam Bonislavsky, who is my incredible co-writer and did a fantastic job, is also working on this, which is, for example, we went to a hospital recently in Queens, which serves a very diverse population, and we talked to them about how they can institute early detection of cancer in their hospital when patients come in who are not sick. It could be someone who comes in with a broken finger, and they find out if they've done their screening and so on and so forth. So that's the kind of thing we're doing, trying to create models, and that would be one model, that can be adopted by others so that we increase screening. And also, obviously, talking to people in the government, whether it be the city government, the state government, or the federal government. I think we have a better shot, at least in New York City and probably other urban areas and other states, to be able to get them to do something that's really important with their health departments, making sure that screening happens. Delaware did that and actually cut their cancer rate significantly, got a lot more people screened, closed the disparities. So Delaware is a very good model. It's a smaller state, but it can be done. And so that's the other thing we're working on, is getting cities and state, and in particular in the area where I live, to begin to get involved, because the city and states can get this done through their health departments and through community groups, which is how Delaware did it. It was community groups, it was city government, state government, everybody pulling together to get many more people screened. And again, it wasn't perfect. Perfect is the enemy of good, but it cut cancer down significantly and completely closed the disparities. So that's what we're working on, working on initiatives like that. I'm not overly hopeful for the federal government, and the one thing, well, anyhow, so I'm not very, I really think it's going to have to be done on a city and state level, and it can be done, because they're all health departments, and we have a model. We have what I call the Delaware model. So that's what we're working on. That's what I'm spending virtually all my extra time on, that, on really creating initiatives. And we have a small team that's doing that, but we have a lot of community groups and so on that are interested. For example, the hospital I mentioned earlier, they were so excited to have us. They were so excited the idea that they could get screening. Because, look, the hospital doesn't want to see somebody go through the, you know, a six-hour operation for advanced cancer. They would much prefer to catch it early and really make sure that they don't have to do that kind of surgery and put that kind of expenses. Because, frankly, hospitals, you know, advanced cancer is not necessarily something that the doctors like. In fact, they don't like it. Surgeons don't like it. Surgeons would much prefer to find cancer very early and do a much simpler operation and more successful operation. After all, doctors are people who care about patients in general, and they don't like to see their patients go through all that. They'd much prefer that it be caught earlier. So we've got that partnership that's available if we can do it.
This is so inspiring. How can our listeners learn more about your efforts and get involved? And how can they get the book?
So the book will come out June 11th. Get it, OR Books. That is the best way to get it, because I will tell you something. OR Books was probably the only publishing house that would do this book, because they're incredible. It's a muckraking book. We all know what they do. They do very progressive work. They did Michael's work. And honestly, they were kind enough to say, okay, we'll take a chance on this one. I think it's worked out for them. Go to OR Books. Go to OR Books and get screened also. So those are two ways to get involved. And I think the other thing is really talk to other people. And if you have some influence on your local government or community group, get involved and talk about this. Have them read the book or listen to the book or whatever they do, because that's the way in which I'm finding people get involved. They read the book. And I was surprised, frankly, that the book got so well accepted by people and that they're so interested in the subject. What it really says is the fact that they're interested in the subject says that it really was something that was out there, and hopefully the book is bringing out what doctors really feel, what scientists really feel, is catch it early. And that's really, I'm so surprised that this has happened, that I've gotten such interest in the book. You know, I thought, okay, I do a book would be nice, and I want to really tell the story, and I can want to be advocate. But what's happening is something I never expected. It's waking up lots of people that actually can make a change. And we can all make some change, I can tell you that, every one of us. It could be maybe we have a father or parent or friend who smokes or used to smoke. Just imagine saving one life by doing that. So each of us can save a life by someone who maybe has smoked. That alone, save a life. You know, this person that recently, found this early lung cancer, I can't believe I saved a life.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
You know, thank you for having me on, really. It has so much meaning to me, really. You guys are great. Thank
for
you
us,
again.
Too, Bruce. You've really made a significant contribution, like your brother, Michael. We appreciate your being on Law & Disorder Radio. You take it easy in every success.
Hey, I'm almost crying, as you can hear. Thank you,
Bruce. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.